Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, April 27th, 2023. The Biden administration announces the creation of immigration processing centers in Central and South America to try to reduce the number of migrants coming directly to the U.S. This all comes 2 weeks before the regulation called Title 42 expires that had been allowing the U.S. to turn away asylum seekers at the southern border on COVID-19 public health emergency grounds. Coming up, the Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, and we talk with Washington Post Homeland Security Department reporter Nick Miroff. House Republican leaders unveiling an immigration and border security reform package that puts limits on asylum seekers and would require completion of former President Trump's border wall. A House floor vote expected in 2 weeks. The Senate today defeating a bill to remove the ratification deadline for the Equal Rights Amendment. Removing that deadline would have made the ERA the 28th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. House defeating a resolution that would have required the president to remove U.S. armed forces from Somalia, the resolution brought up under the War Powers Act of 1973. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol addressing a joint meeting of Congress, and President Biden taking questions from children of White House staff on this Take Your Child to Work Day on issues great and small, his administration's accomplishments, and what he had for breakfast. From the Washington Post, the Biden administration said Thursday it will set up new immigration processing centers in Colombia and Guatemala as part of a series of measures in anticipation for an expected border surge next month when the White House lifts pandemic-era restrictions. The centers will invite more migrants to apply to come to the United States legally by boosting refugee admissions, increasing family reunification visas, and expanding other lawful channels. Migrants who do not apply to come through the expanded legal options will face stiffer consequences if they cross the U.S. southern border, including fast-tracking deportations. The Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas talking about this today at the State Department at a news conference with the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken.
This is a hemispheric challenge that demands hemispheric solutions. Working with our neighbors in the region, we can and will reduce the number of migrants who reach our southern border. The regional processing centers announced today will be a critical addition to the programs and processes DHS has in place for qualifying individuals to obtain authorization to enter the United States before arriving at our borders. This is particularly important because we have a humanitarian obligation to cut the smugglers out. We have seen a dramatic rise in the reach, sophistication, and cruelty of the smuggling organizations over the past 10 years and the challenges that presents. The comprehensive plan we have developed and are executing takes this reality into account. We are building lawful pathways for people to come to the United States without resorting to the smugglers. At the same time, we are imposing consequences on those who do not use those pathways and instead irregularly migrate to our southern border. This plan has proven effective. Building on the success of Uniting for Ukraine, we created parole processes for qualifying Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans, and we expelled individuals from these countries who sought to enter at our southern border. We have seen a high degree of interest in these parole processes and a dramatic drop in encounters from these nationalities. Overall, the number of Border Patrol encounters in March 2023 was down 23% compared to March of last year. When people have safe and orderly pathways to come to the United States and face consequences for failing to do so, they use those pathways. After May 11th, our court-compelled use of Title 42 will end, and we will once again process all migrants under Title 8 of the United States Code. This is a long-standing immigration enforcement authority that multiple administrations, Republican and Democratic alike, have used to process individuals. It carries stiff consequences for irregular migration, including at least a 5-year ban on reentry and potential criminal prosecution for repeated attempts to cross unlawfully. The return to processing migrants under Title 8 authorities will be swift and immediate.
Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas at the State Department with the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. More now on the Biden administration's plans for immigration and border security. We're joined on the phone by Nick Miroff, Washington Post reporter who covers the Homeland Security Department. Thanks for being with us. The Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, talked about these new processing centers that they're opening up in Latin America, calling them new and innovative. Are they new? How would they work? And will they work?
Well, they're definitely a new attempt to try to fix a very old and seemingly intractable challenge, which is how to get people to not migrate north to the United States and cross the border illegally. And so what they're trying to do here is they're making a bet on expanding legal options for migrants who would like to come to the United States, essentially giving them more opportunities to apply to come legally, while also trying to balance that with the threat of tougher penalties for those who don't take advantage of those opportunities and cross the border without permission.
The administration says that Canada and Spain will also accept migrants referred from these centers. Why those two countries?
Well, those are the countries that, number one, are major destinations for migrants from Latin America as well. And I think the administration is especially pleased with this element of it because it's emphasizing that it wants to regionalize the migration challenge with the idea that asylum seekers or others who are trying to flee persecution shouldn't only think about coming to the United States, and that other developed countries need to do more to take in migrants, refugees, and asylum seekers.
The administration also says when the Title 42 authority, the Public Health Emergency Authority, goes away to turn back asylum seekers on May 11th, they'll be returning to what was in place in the past. What are those provisions and how effective are they?
Well, that's basically saying we're just going to go back to our standard immigration laws and procedures at the border. And as many of your listeners recall, those proved to be quite insufficient for previous administrations, including the Trump administration, which devoted so much of its resources and attention to trying to prevent people from crossing illegally. But what the Biden administration means in this case is that rather than quickly expelling people under the pandemic policy, under that Title 42 policy, they're now going to go through the actual legal procedure of a formal deportation, which carries more consequences, including like a 5-year ban on reentering the United States and the threat of criminal prosecution under federal law.
We're talking with Washington Post reporter Nick Miroff. That May 11th date has been known for a while. A lot of preparations in place for it. What is the Homeland Security Department expecting once that date passes?
Well, they're expecting the number of people crossing the border illegally to go over 10,000 per day. There have been projections for as many as 18,000 daily. That is a huge increase. Right now, we're already at record levels of illegal crossings. They're at around 7,000 to 8,000 a day. So everything, the Border Patrol, the other U.S. agencies along the border, border communities, they're all facing incredible strain right now. As we know, big city mayors in the United States have also been telling the administration they can't handle more migrants bused to their cities. So this is really going to be kind of a perilous moment politically for the Biden administration, which is already under fire on this issue from Republican critics.
The Homeland Security Secretary also talking about reprogramming some money to handle the surge.
Yeah, Secretary Mayorkas said that DHS notified Congress today that they need to reprogram some funds from their budget. So none of this stuff comes cheap. And if they need to, set up more temporary tent facilities, hire contractors, pay overtime to border agents, all of this stuff is going to be enormously expensive over the coming weeks and months.
And finally, anything announced today require congressional approval?
You know, I mean, you know, how do you fund a center? I mean, partly it's going to depend on like what this stuff looks like. What, how do you fund a processing center abroad? You know, where's the money for that come from? So I think we'll have a better sense in the coming weeks as they give us more details about how they plan to manage this anticipated increase.
Nick Miroff, Washington Post reporter who covers immigration and the Homeland Security Department. His stories at WashingtonPost.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
On Capitol Hill, House Republican leaders formally unveiling an immigration and border security bill that they plan to bring to the floor in a couple of weeks for a vote. The Hill newspaper reports the package joins two bills, one that includes severe restrictions on asylum seekers from the Judiciary Committee and another from the Homeland Security Committee that would require completing former President Trump's border wall. The package comes fresh off a markup, writes The Hill, in which Democrats on the Homeland Security Committee pushed Republicans to scale back a provision that would have been a wholesale ban on any federal funding for any nonprofit that provides aid to an immigrant regardless of how they entered the country. At a press conference today, Republican leaders said they would bring the bill to the floor the same week as Title 42 is set to be lifted. That is May 11th, ending the pandemic-era prohibitions on seeking asylum. Steve Scalise, Republican from Louisiana, is the House Majority Leader.
For months now, since we took the majority, we have been hard at work putting together a strong border security package. When we ran last year to get the majority, Republicans said that among the other items we ran on in our commitment to America, that we would work to secure America's border. Because since the day Joe Biden took office, he took very specific actions to open up America's border. Day one, he halted construction of the wall. He terminated the Remain in Mexico policy, ended agreements with Northern Triangle countries. And Joe Biden sent a message that America's border is open. And millions of people answered that call and started coming across our border illegally. We don't know the exact number because the White House won't tell the American people how many have come across our border illegally, nor will they tell the country where all of those people have gone. Governors don't even know how many people are sent into their states at dark of night that will be put into their school systems. Who knows what else has happened? We do know this. Many people on the terrorist watch list have been caught coming across our southern border since Joe Biden opened it up. Again, we've never been able to find out an exact number, and that's something we're working on, but it's something that should concern all Americans. And we're not just talking about people coming from South and Central America. We've already identified over 140 different countries that are represented coming across our border illegally since Joe Biden took office. This is a national crisis. It's creating a lot of other problems, too. We see the fentanyl crisis and how bad it's gotten. Last year, we lost almost 100,000 young people who died from drug overdoses from drugs like fentanyl, which are made in China, passed through the cartels across our open southern border. Every single day in America, nearly 300 young people die because of fentanyl overdoses due to Joe Biden's open southern border. And what has President Biden's answer been? Every day, yesterday, today, 300 young people will die from drug overdoses from fentanyl. Tomorrow, another 300 people will die because of overdoses from drugs like fentanyl. And yet President Biden doesn't want to do a thing to change that because he wants an open southern border. Well, I can tell you House Republicans are fed up and House Republicans are taking action. The chairman and members behind me have been hard at work in the committees of jurisdiction, Judiciary Committee, Homeland Security Committee, the Foreign Affairs Committee, all have taken action now over the last few weeks to put together what I would call the strongest border security package that Congress has ever taken up. And when we return in May, the same week that Title 42 expires, we're going to bring a border security package and pass it through this House of Representatives, and we challenge President Biden to work with us to solve this problem.
The House Majority Leader Steve Scalise, Republican from Louisiana, at a news conference today on Capitol Hill. More from the Hill.com article on this House Republican border security immigration bill that's being introduced. Other measures reinstate family detention, including for minors, and mandate that asylum-seeking families be detained for the duration of their legal process. Another portion seeks to limit who can qualify for asylum, expanding from 6 to 15 the list of felonies and misdemeanors that exclude people from asylum eligibility. Bill also raises penalties for visa overstays, targeting those who secure visas to enter the U.S. but remain in the country after their permitted window. The Senate today failed to advance a bill that would allow the Equal Rights Amendment to be added to the U.S. Constitution. The vote in the Senate was 51 to 47, short of the 60 votes needed. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, changed his vote from yes to no for a procedural reason. It allows him to call for a revote in the future. The ERA passed Congress in 1972 and was sent to the states, where approval of three-fourths of state legislatures was needed for ratification. That happened when Virginia ratified in 2020. But the ERA had set a deadline for ratification of initially 1978, then it was extended to 1982. Today's bill in the Senate would simply remove the deadline. Today's Senate vote was mostly Democrats voting yes and Republicans voting no. Two Republicans did vote yes, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. Senator Murkowski spoke on the floor before that vote.
Yes, some have suggested that the ERA is no longer needed. We've certainly made great strides as women since 1923, but there's a lot more that needs to be done. Women are a majority of the U.S. population, but continue to be underrepresented in elected office, in the courts, in the business world, and in so many other areas. There remains, of course, a pay gap. We know of this. We hear the statistics all the time. Pay gap between men and women, 18 cents on the dollar, according to the GAO, and that gap is wider across industries and within certain groups, to 22 cents on the dollar for women at private, for nonprofit, or for for-profit companies, and 23 cents for full-time managers. As Senator from Maryland has mentioned, ERA is also needed to help address violence against women. Statistics from the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, for example, show that 1 in 7 women compared to 1 in 25 men have been injured by an intimate partner. Again, what the Equal Rights Amendment provides, it would establish fundamental protections against discrimination based on sex. Every one of us should agree that such discrimination is completely unacceptable and that every citizen, regardless of sex, should enjoy the same rights under our Constitution. And that's all we're doing here today.
Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican from Alaska, today on the Senate floor before the vote on a bill that would remove the ratification deadline for the Equal Rights Amendment, which was 1982, allowing the states who ratified after that to count and therefore make the ERA the 28th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The amendment reads, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith, Republican from Mississippi, voted no today. She did not speak on the floor before the vote, but she did talk about her opposition back in February at a Judiciary Committee hearing.
Women are already protected from discrimination under the law through the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which ensures equal protection under the law. Women's rights are also protected by the Equal Pay Act of 1963, the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Title IX of the Education Amendment of 1972, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act of 1978, and more. The Equal Rights Amendment would only muddy the waters. Because of its vague language, it would work to undo many of these great achievements, and it does not allow for any distinction between men and women, even when it would make sense to do so based on biological differences. I'm particularly concerned about the privacy and the safety for women and girls that the Equal Rights Amendment would destroy. Locker rooms, prisons, hospital rooms, domestic violence shelters, and restrooms would allow men into areas where women should feel safe and protected and have privacy. Advocates of the ERA are also no longer shy about their goal to use ERA to impose unrestricted abortion on demand up to the moment of birth across the nation and to enforce taxpayers to pay for this.
Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith, Republican from Mississippi, at a hearing in February on the Equal Rights Amendment. Again, the Senate voting today on whether to advance a bill that, if passed, would make the ERA part of the U.S. Constitution. The Senate vote was a majority, but short of the 60 votes needed. Reuters reports that whatever the vote outcome, the ERA will face legal challenges. Some states change their positions over time, with legislatures that once ratified the amendment later rejecting it. It's unclear whether those states would be bound by their initial votes. This is Washington Today. One day after the House passed a bill to raise the national debt limit and cut federal spending, the House Republican majority and President Biden appear no closer to an agreement to avoid default on the national debt expected in a couple of months for the first time in U.S. history. The president says he wants a standalone debt limit increase bill. Congresswoman Lauren Boebert, Republican from Colorado, tweeted this video today.
Reckless historic spending spearheaded by Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi have caused record inflation, interest rate increases, and instability in the banking system. This week, House Republicans took a responsible approach to the debt ceiling. Was H.R. 2811 everything I wanted? No. Given we are more than $31 trillion in debt, I personally think we need to get way more aggressive with spending cuts and begin to shrink our completely out of control federal government. Having said that, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimated that the Limit Save Grow Act would cut federal spending by $4.8 trillion over a 10-year period. The bill also blocked Biden's $500 billion student loan bailout, rescinded nearly $60 billion in unspent COVID funds, repealed the Green New Deal tax credits, defunded Biden's new 87,000 IRS agents, and strengthened work requirements for federal government programs. The bill capped discretionary spending at fiscal year 2022 levels while allowing for 1% growth annually over 10 years to limit federal spending. At a time when the U.S. dollar is in trouble, foreign adversaries are working hard to move away from the U.S. dollar. We can't risk the full faith and credit of America. The House took responsible action to ensure we did not default on our debt. It's completely irresponsible for the president to refuse to negotiate on this matter and to sit like a king in the high castle saying that it's his way or the highway.
Congresswoman Lauren Boebert, Republican from Colorado, posting that video. Now to the White House and questions to the press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre.
House Republicans passed legislation on the budget and debt limit. What is the White House's response to this? And do you feel like the ball is in your court now to, you know, start negotiations with House Republicans on the next move?
So a couple of things I want to say about this. Let's just take a step back for a second. The United States has never in our history failed to pay our debt. That is something that we have never done ever, again, in our history of this country. We're not a deadbeat nation. Avoiding default is Congress's responsibility, and they should act on it without preconditioned, as they have done in Democratic and Republican administrations, and they should do that immediately. House Republicans are holding our economy hostage and threatening default, crashing the economy, jeopardizing hardworking Americans' retirement, and causing millions of Americans to lose their jobs. As the president said yesterday, he's happy to meet with Speaker McCarthy, but not on whether or not the debt limit gets extended. That is not negotiable, and we have been very clear about this for the past several months. We have not minced words here. House Republicans are holding the economy hostage, threatening Americans' jobs and retirement savings unless we and the Senate agree on an extreme MAGA wish list of slashing education, veterans' health care, and Meals on Wheels, taking away health care for millions of Americans, and sending manufacturing jobs overseas. It'll increase cost of working families, as I've talked about before from here at this podium. on what this bill will do. It'll kill jobs, and it's all to pay for tax cuts for the super rich and profitable companies. It's not how we grow our economy. The president has been very clear how he sees our economy moving forward. He has actually put forth pieces of legislation and policy on how he sees this, the economy moving forward. And it's not trickle-down economics. It is building the economy from the bottom up, middle out, and making sure we leave no Americans behind. We leave no one behind. And what we're seeing from what Republicans have put forward, it will leave people behind. It will hurt Americans, including veterans, including our seniors, just Americans across the board. So, again, we took a step back. We are not negotiating on this. We have been very clear. It is their constitutional duty to take action.
The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre at her daily briefing with reporters in the White House briefing room. Wall Street today, the Dow up 524, NASDAQ up 287, S&P up 79. Commerce Department says the U.S. economy grew more slowly in the first 3 months of 2023 compared to the fourth quarter of 2022. Gross domestic product increased 1.1% annualized rate. That's down from 2.6% fourth quarter of last year. President Biden with a statement saying, "Today we learn the American economy remains strong as it transitions to steady and stable growth. This past quarter, real personal disposable income increased, and American consumers continued to spend even as the overall pace of growth moderated." A story from Fox News, the Biden administration is continuing its aggressive push to develop a direct e-file system for Americans to submit taxes, despite an internal study showing it is unpopular. The IRS commissioned study obtained by Fox News Digital, which was required under the Inflation Reduction Act and conducted earlier this year by the nonpartisan MITRE Corporation, found that Americans overwhelmingly prefer commercial tax preparation software over a hypothetical government-managed system under a series of scenarios. The only scenario where a direct e-file system would be preferred, according to the study, is for the minority of Americans who file complex returns. The main reason for the disparity between the two options is the cost of commercial software for complex returns. That reporting from Fox News. The IRS Commissioner Daniel Werfel testified today before the House Ways and Means Committee and was asked about this by the committee chair, Jason Smith, Republican from Missouri.
The Inflation Reduction Act spends $15 million to pay for a supposedly independent analysis about the feasibility of setting up an e-file system through the IRS, which would essentially make the agency the American people's tax filer, their tax collector, but also their auditor. Asking the IRS to do your taxes is like asking your kid to guard the cookie jar. The temptation to take more than their so-called fair share is too much. Nevertheless, you all choose to hire an organization, New America, and a tax attorney, both of which have stated their support for establishing such an e-file system. How are we to expect this will be an impartial review if those in charge of it are already committed to seeing it happen?
Thank you for the question, Mr. Chairman. When I arrived at the IRS, I learned that we have this study that's mandated under the Inflation Reduction Act to study a direct file option. I want to stress the word option there because I think the important thing is whether we go forward with a direct file solution or not, and if we were to, it is an option for taxpayers. If they feel concerned about engaging with the IRS in a direct file solution, they don't have to do it. There are other ways to engage with the IRS. And that's, by the way, part of our hope and our vision that we will meet taxpayers where they are. If they want to file in paper, we're not thrilled with it, but we'll be ready for it. If they want a fully digital experience, if they want to work with a third-party servicer, we want to accommodate that. They currently don't have a direct file option, so my understanding from the Inflation Reduction Act is to study it and see if it's viable. The report's not done yet. It will be done by mid-May. And I understand, Mr. Chairman, that you have a keen interest in seeing what this report says. I will make myself available once the report is out to answer any questions that you have. I'm happy to come back to this committee and testify on it. I just think it would be premature to get into the details of the study before it's finalized.
You know, our committee has learned that a different organization, a MITRE, that occasionally does work for the IRS conducted a study around taxpayer opinions about an IRS e-file system. Among their findings, most working class Americans who file simple tax returns do not want an IRS system. And the plan is only popular in cases where the IRS could pull off handling complex tax returns and providing state returns, basically adding a tax preparation software company inside the IRS. A lack of trust in government was one of the main reasons taxpayers would oppose an IRS system. And without objection, I'll be submitting the MITRE study for the record. So ordered. Commissioner Werfel, why wasn't the IRS transparent with the American people about this study?
Well, I want to make clear, Mr. Chairman, the IRS didn't ask for this study. We didn't commission the study. Often you have companies, nonprofits, academics on their own writing white papers, writing studies that the IRS didn't ask for. But if they send it to us, then we absolutely will look at it, in particular if it's credible, and MITRE is a very credible organization. And we have received the study from MITRE, and we were under the impression that it was going to be made public so that there wasn't a need to immediately report it out. But there was no intention of holding anything back here. People send us studies, we review them, and we will incorporate the findings from the MITRE study into our final study.
IRS Commissioner Daniel Werfel before the House Ways and Means Committee. Questions from the chair, Congressman Jason Smith, Republican from Missouri. C-SPAN covered this entire hearing. You can find the video at our website, cspan.org. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now free app. The Air National Guardsman accused of leaking classified documents, Jack Teixeira, had another court appearance today. Prosecutors arguing that he should remain behind bars because he poses a serious flight risk and that a foreign adversary could try to help him escape the United States and give him safe haven, and that he's an ongoing threat to national security because he may still have access to more classified information that would be valuable to hostile countries. In a pre-hearing filing, the government said that Jack Teixeira had a history of making violent and racist remarks, including posting on social media about wanting to carry out a mass shooting and also keeping an arsenal of weapons and tactical gear at his house, and also trying to thwart federal investigators by apparently destroying evidence. Some questions about that memo and the investigation today to the Pentagon Press Secretary, Pat Ryder.
The court papers released today indicate he received a sensitive compartmented information clearance in July of 2021. That's like one of the highest classifications. Would it be accurate to say that your investigation is reviewing whether the SCI process as it now stands is adequate and should have caught some of these signals? You know, 5 months later, he was accessing documents he should not have.
Yeah, so broadly speaking, the department is looking at our security process, as I mentioned, right, to include the process by which we vet and provide security clearances. So that is part of the ongoing review. Again, as it relates to this particular individual, I'm not going to comment on him other than to say you have essentially a network administrator working in an intelligence wing, which is by default working with a lot of TSSEI type of information. So that in and of itself is not unusual. But again, as it relates to the airmen, DOJ is investigating. In the meantime, we're looking at our processes and procedures across our intelligence community, and also in terms of the DOD security process.
Some pressure here, though, at DOD to reassure the public that somebody with the highest of classifications under a special access program, I guess that's even higher, somebody with that SCI clearance cavalierly allegedly violated that act, that pledge.
Yeah, so a couple things. So first of all, as I've mentioned before, if we're going to award you a security clearance, it's going to be pretty stringent requirements to get that security clearance. First of all, there is going to be a background check. You're going to take training, and you're going to sign a non-disclosure agreement. So, you know, at the end of the day, it is not something that you just get. It's something that you have to essentially earn and then maintain that. However, if an individual decides to break the law willfully, that's a different story. So again, the vast, vast majority of people who are awarded security clearances come to work every day and do the right thing. And this investigation will tell us what happened and where this individual did the wrong thing.
The Pentagon Press Secretary, Air Force Brigadier General Pat Ryder, taking reporters' questions in the Pentagon briefing room. The suspect, Jack Teixeira, has been in custody since his arrest on April 13th. After his court appearance today, the judge said that he will rule on whether he will stay behind bars at a future date. This story from Roll Call. Justice Department and intelligence officials face a skeptical Congress as they push to renew a contentious surveillance law in what could be a drawn-out battle between the Biden administration and lawmakers. Intelligence community officials have walked a fine line in making their pitch, touting the surveillance power as a cornerstone of national security, while seeking to reassure lawmakers that they understand the importance of protecting civil liberties. That from Roll Call. At issue is Section 702 of FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which permits the government to do targeted wiretap surveillance of foreign persons outside the United States. The FBI Director Christopher Wray was asked about Section 702 today at a House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing.
Obviously, strongly agree about what an indispensable tool 702 is. I'll try to answer as quickly as I can. On China, in a world without 702, the FBI would have lost one of its most powerful tools to detect attempts by Chinese hackers to, you know, pre-position on our cyber and critical infrastructure systems and to root out those hackers before they can act or to stop foreign cyber attacks while in progress. Almost every day through our 702 intelligence, we see evidence of China's efforts to surveil and steal information about our military, about our advanced technologies, to hack our critical infrastructure, and even to run influence and intimidation campaigns against Americans and Chinese dissidents here. And so without 702, the intelligence community would be blinded in an ever-evolving digital world. Much of what I just said would apply to cyber more generally, because, of course, the Chinese, although they have the biggest hacking program in the world, are hardly the only cyber threat. And so it's a very important tool for us against the Russians, against the Iranians, and other dangerous foreign adversaries. As to the reforms, I have put in place a whole slew of reforms, especially on 702, especially over the last 18 months or so. Those include all sorts of new policies and procedures, new training, new systems changes, new oversights, new safeguards, new approvals, new double checks. I stood up a whole new office of internal audit. There was no such thing at the FBI before. We have an inspection division, which does great work, but we stood up an office of internal audit, brought back a retired agent who had gone on to be a partner at a Big Four accounting firm to help us stand that up, and we're working with another Big Four accounting firm to help make sure that the audit program we've built out is best in class, and it is specifically focused on FISA compliance. And the reason I bring those things up is that almost every report the members of this subcommittee would have seen about compliance violations and incidents that we've had in the past, even though some of those reports came out, you know, in the last, let's say, 6 months to a year, they all cover time periods that predate those reforms. And so I am confident that the reforms that we've put in place, as we start getting more and more new information, more recent information, will show that we've made significant progress. But I also want to be clear that this is not a one and done for me. This is something I take very seriously, and that this is a long-term project that we're going to be constantly improving, constantly looking for ways to tighten up and improve our compliance, because this is, I think, that's part of being a high-performing organization on a program that is so important. And I just cannot underscore enough the importance of 702 to the American people in terms of foreign threats. As somebody who, in a past life, when I served in the Justice Department, in the Bush administration and was in FBI headquarters on 9/11 and spent time with the families of the 9/11 victims in, during my time as Assistant Attorney General. I never want to have to look at families and tell them there was something we could have done that was fully constitutional that we chose not to do to help keep them safe.
The FBI Director Christopher Wray before a House Appropriations Subcommittee today. Section 702 expires at the end of the year. The House Republican majority is somewhat divided on this issue. Congressman Dutch Ruppersberger of Maryland, who asked Director Wray the question you just heard him answer, supports reauthorization. Congressman Jim Jordan, Republican of Ohio, Judiciary Committee Chair, has said he is opposed. From defense news, the House on Thursday voted 101 to 321 against withdrawing U.S. troops in Somalia, even as Africa Command asked Congress for more funds to establish a persistent presence in the war-torn country. Congressman Matt Gaetz, Republican of Florida, used expedited measures laid out in the War Powers Act to force a floor vote on his resolution, which would have directed President Joe Biden to remove all U.S. troops from Somalia except those assigned to protect the embassy within a year. Here is Congressman Gaetz on the House floor before the vote.
There are currently 900 U.S. troops in Somalia, give or take, and this resolution would bring them home. Somalia is a country of 17 million, tortured at times by Al-Shabaab, a group of roughly 7,000 hardened fighters and even more sympathizers. But to believe any of the arguments, just logically, that my colleagues are making, you have to believe that 900 U.S. troops is what is going to save a country of 17 million from a hardened group of 7,000. I think that strains not only logic, but our understanding of the history of Somalia, a country that has oscillated between failed state and just absolute coup revolution over and over again, civil war, sectarian violence. The future of Somalia must be determined by Somalia. And to the extent that foreign influences could be helpful, I would argue that the African Union is far better positioned to build a stronger sense of national identity and national unity among clans that have been warring in Somalia for generations than U.S. troops. I have yet to see the evidence that U.S. troops are the essential element to fusing relationships among warring African warlords, clans, and tribes.
Congressman Matt Gaetz, Republican from Florida, today on the House floor, sponsor of this resolution. Speaking in opposition, Congressman Gregory Meeks, Democrat from New York, ranking member on the Foreign Affairs Committee.
It is a fact that Al-Shabaab and other terrorist organizations like ISIS control large swaths of territory in Somalia. But local forces from the Somalia government and the African Union Transition Mission in Somalia have made steady gains, yes, steady gains, the past several years. United States forces have been instrumental in some of these changes because of the very training and intelligence support we provide to local forces on the ground. By mandating that our forces cease security cooperation in Somalia, this resolution would roll back some of the gains that have been made to take back territory from terrorist organizations in the past several years. This measure doesn't end American hostilities in the region. It includes nothing about removing American forces from other nations in the region where groups like Al-Shabaab operate. And it does nothing to address over-the-horizon strikes. While I disagree with this measure, let me say, and what I do agree with, that we are having this debate. It is one that is long overdue. American forces have been in Somalia and other parts of the world without proper engagement from the United States Congress.
Congressman Gregory Meeks, Democrat from New York, on the House floor before the House voted to reject the resolution to require the U.S. troops to come home from Somalia. The vote was 102 yes and 321 no. On the yes side, 52 Republicans and 50 Democrats. U.S. intervention in Somalia goes back to 1992, and then President George H.W. Bush sent in Marines for emergency assistance amid a civil war. A year later, U.S. Special Forces ambushed by Somali militias in the deadly incident that became the basis of the novel and film adaptation Black Hawk Down. And since al-Shabaab rose to power in 2006, U.S. has sought to defeat that militant group through airstrikes and training local forces and conducting special force operations. President Biden reversed an order from former President Trump, who had pulled out U.S. forces, to send them back in. From CNA, the Channel News Asia, South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol celebrated Seoul's stronger-than-ever alliance with Washington in a joint meeting of Congress on Thursday as the partners unite to deter North Korea's nuclear threat. President Yoon is on a week-long U.S. state visit to mark the 70th anniversary of the friendship. President Yoon talked about economic trade as well between the U.S. and South Korea and cultural exchanges in such areas as movies, TV shows, and music.
And even if you didn't know my name, you may know BTS and Blackpink. BTS beat me to the White House, but I beat them to Capitol Hill. Korean and American singers reaching high places in each other's music charts is no longer a surprise. The U.S. create a global platforms like Netflix. Korea has produced a popular series such as Squid Game. We are creating a new pattern of synergy. These cultural exchanges have brought our people closer. According to Chicago Council on Global Affairs, Americans' positive views of Korea have reached the highest level since 1978. And according to a Pew survey last year, Koreans' positive views of the U.S. have reached 89%. It marks the largest increase among all the countries surveyed.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol giving a speech before a joint meeting of Congress today in Washington. And speaking of music, a clip of President Yoon at Wednesday night's state dinner at the White House has gone viral as he sings the 1972 hit song, American Pie.
A long, long time ago. I can still remember how that music used to make me smile.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol at the White House state dinner Wednesday night. President Biden then gave him a guitar signed by the original singer of that song, American Pie, Don McLean. Today is National Take Your Child to Work Day. The Take Our Daughters and Sons to Work Foundation writes that exposing children to what a parent or mentor does during the workday is important, but showing them the value of their education, helping them discover the power and possibilities of work and family life, providing boys and girls a chance to share how they envision the future, and allowing them to begin steps toward their goals in a hands-on and interactive environment is key to their achieving success. President Biden met today with the children of the staff of the White House on the South Lawn of the White House and took some of their questions.
What makes you hopeful for the next generation?
You. I said, what makes me hopeful for the next generation of Americans? The generation of Americans, from you guys to people all the way to their late 20s, is the most open, the least prejudiced, the best educated, and the most giving generation in American history, for real, not a joke. And that's why I'm so hopeful, because in America, we can do anything, anything at all if we do it together, for real. There's not a single thing we can't do. And what gives me the most hope is all you guys, for real, and that's the guys too. Anyway, yes.
What's your favorite color?
My favorite color is blue. Not because when I started off, it wasn't red and blue states. It was everything was anyway. That's my favorite color.
President Biden with the children of White House staff on this National Take Your Child to Work Day. And standing in front of the president as he gave some formal remarks, four kids acting as the president's Secret Service agents, complete with blazers and mirrored sunglasses. You can find the video at our website at cspan.org. And thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word, to get the stories Washington is talking about. Email to you every day. Subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.